Hey, everybody. It's that time again. It's time for the With a Bullet podcast. My name is Todd Golden. I'm here with my younger brother, Matt Golden. Matt, what's going on?
Not a whole lot. It's Thursday. I don't think we've ever recorded on a Thursday.
It's
before,
Thursday night
actually.
Football. It's the Titans and the Jaguars, baby.
Yes, yes.
We had some technical gremlins yesterday that neither one of us can quite explain at this point that prevented us from recording on our usual day yesterday. So we're here today, ready to knock this shit out of the park. What chart are we doing this week, Matt? It was your pick.
Well, we're going to 1977. We haven't done 1977 before, but it's the British charts. And this covers July 24th through July 30th. And it was kind of the summer of punk in the UK, or when it was kind of reaching its popularity on the charts. The Sex Pistols were kind of coming into their own, I guess. But there's also some other punk and new wave, but also like some crossover from disco and actually some prog and stuff like that on it too. Actually very little crossover between this and the American chart from this week though. So
here's the part where I use a fake British accent to use words that people don't use here. You tit.
okay.
Anyway, that wasn't even a British accent. That was just a British word that they use. Let's get started.
Yep.
Number 40.
Okay.
Right on brand for what you picked this week is God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols.
And this was the first Sex Pistols song I remember hearing. I may have heard Motley Crue's horrible cover of Anarchy in the UK first, but this is the first from the band that I actually remember hearing. And it was obviously controversial in the UK. They compared Queen Elizabeth to a fascist regime, and they say that she ain't no human being. And it was promoted with a poster that had a picture of her with a safety pin in her nose and stuff like that. And its original title was No Future, which is kind of repeated over and over in the outro, but Malcolm McLaren insisted on changing it to God Save the Queen to tie in with Queen Elizabeth's Silver Jubilee, which was happening a month before this, celebrating her 25th year on the throne. And she's actually on her 68th now. But he also thought that No Future sounded like something from a bank ad. Because of the title change, McLaren and John Lydon, John Rotten, almost came to blows over it. And it was supposed to come out on A&M Records, but the label dropped them while the first pressing was being made. And they destroyed most of the copies, but some of them leaked out and they're worth a fortune now. Median price on Discogs of $7,800. High price is 16 grand for that. So if you get an A&M copy of God Save the Queen, you can probably cash in on it. But it ended up being released on Virgin, but that almost didn't happen either because the workers refused to press it because of the content. But eventually it did get out, but it was banned by the BBC. And Woolworths, who was a big retailer, refused to sell it. But it still managed to sell 150,000 copies in its first week. But it didn't make it to number one. Made it to number two. But there are some accusations that the official charts, which is the source for this chart, kind of fudged the numbers a little bit so it wouldn't make to the top. To actually promote the single during the Jubilee itself, the Sex Pistols actually went down the Thames in a barge called the Queen Elizabeth and played this song, and they ended up getting arrested for doing that. But big song, kind of like evocative of the early punk movement. And one funny thing to throw out is that it was actually a snippet of it was played in the opening ceremonies of the 2012 Olympics while the Queen was in attendance. So a little bit funny there, but
I like this song for one simple reason that nobody ever brings up.
What's that?
It rocks.
It does rock. Nobody, it does rock.
Nobody ever brings that up about punk rock. I mean, not all punk rock is created equally, but this song and the Sex Pistols are weird because they're almost a metal band, like posing as a punk band. I mean, they had metal isn't the right way to put it, but they're a hard rock band that happened to play glom onto the punk style, I guess. And almost all their songs on a bass level just rock, and that's why I like it.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely what pulled me in at first for them. But yeah. I mean, they definitely. I mean, they weren't a ballad band by any means.
No, and their lyrics are of the time and dated, really. I mean, honestly, a lot of it is, and so what you have left is. You have the fact that you can, you know, bang your head to it, basically.
Pretty much. Let's see. But, I mean, it also, I mean, you mentioned hard rock, but, I mean, Paul Cook and Steve Jones were definitely into the Faces, so you get that influence. But also, the New York Dolls, who Malcolm McLaren managed before this, and they actually ended up with the New York Dolls instruments, believe it or not. But they sound similar and kind of the same thing where they kind of punk but also hard rock too. So.
You know what my brush with the New York Dolls is?
Well, what's that?
I stood behind them when they checked out of a hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm not making that up.
Nice.
Dave Johansen, when he was still alive, was there. That was about... Oh, I was down in, it was in Nashville. It was for a basketball trip. I'm trying to remember what trip that was. I think I was there for, I don't remember. But, oh, I was down there. I was at Middle Tennessee State, but I stayed in Nashville. So that would have been like 06 or 07, thereabouts. So, yeah, true story. That's, I'm not making that up.
Cool.
Yeah, see. Very cool. I know... The New York Dolls say we checked out in front of Todd Golden. That's what they probably do.
But anyway, let's move on to 39 here, which is Joe Walsh with Rocky Mountain Way.
Well, it just seems exceedingly odd that this is on the UK chart at all, because it seems to me that some classic rock songs do work on both shores and were popular on both shores, but this doesn't seem to be like one that would be. Because it's very, I don't know why. I mean, there's no real reason for me to feel that way. But Joe Walsh style hard rock doesn't strike me as something that, you know, English people in 1977 would really be into. And what's even weirder is that this is 4 years after it came out in the United States. So
yeah, I was wondering about that.
Well, the only evidence I could find, I couldn't find any documentation of why, but that Joe Walsh. There was a UK-only EP compilation that came out in 77, and this was the lead song off of it. And so presumably that's why. This is as high as it got on the chart. So just kind of an oddball inclusion into the British chart of 1977 that they're rocking out to. Maybe they just like the talk box.
It could be. Wonder how high, Frampton, obviously, with the talk box.
I've got Nazareth. More talk box. I've got more talk box coming. You just wait.
Ooh, good.
Another bizarre one is your next one. Number 38 is Lucille by Kenny Rogers.
This is a skip, actually. It did actually make it to number one, believe it or not, in the UK. which is kind of odd too.
UK country tastes are also strange because there are country artists that do show up on the UK chart from time to time. But it's really
random. Definitely.
It's very random about who it is and who it isn't. So,
right. See, but 37 for you is the Stranglers with Something Better Change.
Well, this is a great song, and this would definitely be categorized as punk, I would think, but it's probably a little bit closer to pub rock if you're gonna split hairs. Pub rock was kind of the older cousin of punk rock. It's based, you know, it doesn't quite have the snarly attitude. Well, it does have the snarly attitude, but it's just probably closer to our classic rock than punk, if you want to. It's hard to make that distinction unless you're into those styles, but that's basically what it is. But this song is just a cool, hard-driving belter. And the lyrics of it, which are by lead singer Jean-Jacques Burnel, which is not a very British name, but the way he sings is very British. I mean, it is definitely straight out of punk central casting with the heavy-duty British accent. They cut into a guitar solo and he goes, "Yeah, take it, Hugh," meaning Hugh, the name of the guitar player. Had it ever been released in America, it wasn't. It would have definitely sounded very punk to U.S. 1977 ears. But the Stranglers didn't stay a punk band. They actually maintained their chart success into the 80s by switching styles. And this was a period, though, where they kind of rocked out. And I actually listened to this album not too long ago. It's off their No More Heroes album, which is a really good listen if you're into late 70s UK rock. It's you know, very raw, very hard driving, you know, a lot of attitude. So that part of it, they definitely got the punk part of it down, but good stuff. Real good stuff, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So anyway, moving on, number 36 for you is This Perfect Day by Saints.
And these guys are one of the best early punk bands. They're from Australia. Brisbane, Australia. They're actually the first band from outside the US or the UK to release a punk single. They were punk. I mean, their music was punk, but they resisted that label and they refused to adopt a punk image, even though their label were kind of trying to push that on them. They basically just wore jeans and t-shirts and stuff. And I knew that they made it on the UK charts, but I wasn't sure which song. I assumed that it was I'm Stranded because that's kind of their signature song and kind of a punk classic. But it ended up being This Perfect Day, which is, it's an okay song, not one of my favorites of theirs. But it was big enough to make it on the charts here, obviously. And apparently it could have been a bigger hit on the charts too. It only peaked at 34, but EMI just decided to stop pressing copies for some reason. No real explanation of that, but
MI.
But they did make it over for a Top of the Pops appearance, and they didn't really seem like they were very into it at all. And the Top of the Pops back then usually had live lead vocals and then the band mimed playing it. But the band just they're just totally going through the motions. They clearly didn't want to be there. So it's kind of funny for that. And the drummer is wearing an ascot for some reason. But the song did end up being covered this year by a contemporary Australian band called Tropical Fuckstorm.
Cool.
present day Australian bands have the absolute worst names. You have those guys, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, Amel and the Sniffers. But yeah, so anyway, Saints.
You know who was in the Saints at that time?
Who?
Archie Manning.
That was a different Saints, but yeah, he was in the Saints in 1977.
No, he was in the punk band too. A lot of people don't know that. That's nice. That's why Peyton Manning is so good on commercials, because his dad was a trailblazing entertainer in his own right.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Archie Manning invented punk.
That's how he got to know Brad Paisley, Peyton Manning.
Yeah. Exactly. But anyway, moving on, Gary Glitter at number 35 with "A Little Boogie Woogie in the Back of My Mind."
Well, you can't help but get a very creepy feeling when you listen to pretty much everything that Gary Glitter ever recorded, considering he's a convicted pedophile a couple times over. He's currently doing his second prison sentence for it after doing he did it some time in Vietnam, which I'm sure that was some fun time. Now he's back, I think,
right,
in the UK, pretty much locked away forever. And many of us, I will say this, I mean, if you can somehow separate what Gary Glitter was versus the music, a lot of it is kind of interesting, I suppose. Different. I mean, it was unique. But the subject matter of nearly all of them is sex, so that makes it even more creepy. I mean, and a lot of it is like...
Exactly.
Like,
yeah,
little girl type sex, too. And in this particular song, Gary goes disco. So he's actually probably the one glam artist who could successfully cross over to disco because of the way his style was. So it actually comes off, but I mean, it's Gary Glitter, so, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's, the chanting and like the big beats on it definitely would work in disco.
Yeah, it's a shame, so, because a lot of his songs are actually halfway entertaining, but you just can't live with yourself going to listen to him. Like, you know, he did the original version of "Do You Want to Touch," and boy, does that song sound creepy when you consider what he was doing. The way
we normally
hear it through Joan Jett, but he did the original version, and there's all kinds of songs like that. So one of those artists that's, you know, pariah to the point, like, if you go looking for Gary Glitter on Spotify, it's hard to find him because I don't think they advertise the fact that he's even on there, you know.
Oh yeah.
They
yeah,
don't,
yeah,
because exactly. Obviously he still makes, I mean, he wrote most of those songs, so he still makes money, you know, off the royalties, even though he's in the hooscow. But
yeah, and that was a controversy when Rock and Roll Part 2 was in the Joker movie,
right,
that he was getting money from it.
Right, exactly. And it's weird when I hear "Do You Want to," some commercial right now has "Do You Want to Touch" in it, and I can't remember which commercial it is, but I'm like, ah, you know, I guess they're paying royalties to Gary Glitter too, because that doesn't go to Joan Jett. It's her version of the commercial, but, you know, so, yeah, kind of a notorious figure.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, next for you, Matt, number 34, "Give a Little Bit" by Supertramp.
I always assume that this song was recorded live. It's fairly common for live songs to be released as singles in this era, or for them to be like released on regular studio albums. And I assume that was the case here, but it wasn't. And like the intro where Roger Hodgson, the lead singer, kind of yells out, "All right, here we go." And the acoustic guitar in it definitely sounds live. And that led me to believe that, but I mean, it was all faked to sound live. And they actually recorded the guitar in an elevator to get that sound. So faking out by Supertramp. But it was written by Roger Hodgson, but it was credited to him and Rick Davies. Supertramp had kind of a arrangement similar to the Beatles, where if one guy wrote the song, it got credited to the guys. And here, Hodgson actually, before Supertramp even started, like back in the early 70s, but he waited 6 years before he thought it was ready to give it to the band. And I've always associated this with the first Superman movie.
Because me too. It's, I was about to say that.
Because it's being played right before Lois Lane gets like run off the road and gets like buried in an avalanche.
Yeah.
So that's,
you know what?
That's like, kind of always stuck out for that.
It has for me too. And I've always been like, Superman, just let her die. She's annoying. Just let her go. You know, you don't need to turn the earth backwards to save her. Go save somebody else. Because she's
right.
Lois Lane is a,
yeah.
At least in that movie, she is.
Right. And this song has a very good example of 70s sax in it, too.
It does.
Actually, one of the better examples of 70s sax. But they did have a video for this, and Supertramp were pretty ugly dudes. So that probably explains why they didn't last very long into the MTV era. I mean, they basically all look like college English professors for the most part. So not the most telegenic band.
No,
so.
No, not at all.
But anyway, number 33 for you is Bo Kirkland and Ruth Davis with You're Gonna Get Next to Me.
This is bad disco, but sometimes bad disco has its charms because the lyrics are dumb, but and the groove is basic, but it still grabs you because all they do throughout most of the song is they go, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're gonna get next to me. And they basically they don't necessarily repeat that over and over. There is actually lyrics, but it's admittedly sort of infectious. So file this under bad disco that is listenable.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I listened to this one too. Isn't this like 10 minutes long or something?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure.
I just remember it being super long.
You know, it's for playing in the club and whatnot. But yeah, I didn't listen to it for that long. Anyway, next for you, another one that's sort of a disco classic. I Just Want to Be Your Everything by Andy Gibb.
This is skipped for me. I once again, we get the Bee Gees or like one of the Gibb brothers on our charts. I think like at least 75% of our charts have had those guys. So.
Yeah, that's true. Although I don't know that we've delved into Andy Gibb much, but you know, I understand that.
Right. Yep. But 31 for you is T-Connection with Do What You Want to Do.
I think I've said this before when we've done UK charts, because didn't we do one from 79?
Yeah, we did. Yep.
It's odd to me that there's this parallel universe between US and UK disco. I don't want to belabor that. I think I talked about that the last time we did this, but there were songs that crossed over on both shores, and then there were disco hits that were only hits on one side of the Atlantic Ocean or the other. And I really don't know why, because it's not like there's some different vibe musically for US disco versus UK disco. It's not like Euro disco, which does sound legitimately different. But this song is kind of cool. This song is by a Bahamian. The T-Connection is from the Bahamas. And it sort of sounds like a raw version of the Jacksons. And it was a hit over here on the disco chart, but it never cracked the top 40 at all in the United States. So it's actually really cool. It's kind of funky and a disco song, but kind of a jam too. So kind of cool.
Yeah. Yep.
That leads into my long distance dedication, since I'm out of long distance dedication jail this week.
Yes. Yes, you are.
This is going to be one of the shortest ones ever. The British chart is only goes down to what, 50, I think, on here.
Yeah, it does.
So
yeah.
I went to the British album chart, and okay, I'm going to throw this out to number 5, 20 all-time greatest hits by Connie Francis. And the reason I bring this up is that, you know, we're talking about how this was the punk era and things were changing and it was revolutionary. Well, that's all true, but a lot of times the charts don't always reflect that. And so I want to give you the top 5 albums on this date in England in 1977. This is at number 5. Live at the Greek by Neil Diamond is at number 4.
Nice.
Going for the One by Yes is number 3.
Okay.
Number 2 is the Star is Born soundtrack, the one from, you know, Barbra Streisand.
Yeah.
And number 1 is the Johnny Mathis collection. So I'm sure there were people in England who were ready for punk, but there were also obviously a lot more people in England ready to get mellow. So
exactly. That is weird. I didn't even look at the album chart. So that is interesting.
And Connie Francis is really random because, you know, she really stopped having hits here in the early 60s. And then she had some tragedies and things like that. And but we were only a year away from her disco version of Where the Boys Are, which I actually went and listened to, and it's not bad, believe it or not.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, one of the bands that I mentioned earlier, the Saints, covered one of her songs. They covered Lipstick on Your Collar.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes the revolutions that we think happen, and then we only think that that was the only thing people were listening to, is not always. This chart kind of reflects it too, less or so, but, you know, it's not like everybody in England all of a sudden started listening to punk. Just like everybody here in the United States didn't suddenly start listening to gangster rap in 1989, or, you know, it's sometimes we overdo it with that type of stuff, I guess. No, not everybody was listening to grunge in 1991 or 92. In fact, probably a lot of people weren't, but
right.
You know, we tend to get lazy with those types of categorizations. So Connie Francis was striking a blow for the establishment in England. Back in
she was
in 77. Margaret Thatcher approved of that, so
probably.
Anyway, moving on for you, Matt. Number 30 is Dreams by Fleetwood Mac.
Todd, did you know that thunder only happens when it's raining?
So I've heard. See, you're stealing my thunder. On my next song, I'm gonna quote lyrics, so I'm gonna sound like I'm copying you, you ass.
Okay. I was also going to ask you if, you know, that players only love you when they're playing.
Yes. So I've heard many times.
I mean, I've heard this song roughly a million times on the radio over the years. And I didn't actually find out that it was called Dreams until like years after I first heard it. And I'm assuming that's because the word dreams is not mentioned in the chorus. It's mentioned in the verses. So I'm assuming that's why. And like most of the songs on Rumors, this has to do with inner band relationship turmoil. In this case, it's Stevie and Lindsey's disintegrating relationship. And she wrote the song kind of on her own in the studio. The rest of the band was working on another song which didn't involve her, so she kind of like snuck off in the corner, and there was a keyboard there, and she started messing around and came up with this. And she went back and showed it to the rest of the band, and they weren't impressed with it. She had to beg them to record it, but ended up becoming a huge hit. Surprisingly, this is their only number one in the U.S., which I was really surprised to find out. They've had a lot of top fives, but that was the only number one. And they also only had one number one in the UK, and it was actually for the Peter Green era.
Yeah, who just died this week, right?
Yeah, yeah, just over this weekend. Albatross was their only number one over here. And the singles from Rumors also didn't do as well in the UK. This only ended up peaking at 24, and it was on the most successful song from the album, but it's still, I mean, still a very successful album. I mean, it did much better on the album's chart than on the singles chart. But there's also a video for this too, which all of the Fleetwood Mac videos from this time period are kind of the same. They're basically just performing it live, and with live audio too. And Lindsey Buckingham is like way off key on the background vocals on that one. But
is this the afroed Lindsey Buckingham?
Yes. Yeah. And he's wearing like an all white 3-piece suit in the video too. So, and Stevie's doing kind of like Stevie type stuff, like playing with a scarf and like twirling around and stuff like that too. So yeah. But big song. I think everybody on earth knows this one, so
I've never heard it, but okay.
But number 29 for you, and you actually just mentioned this in your long distance dedication, A Star Is Born, Evergreen by Barbara Streisand.
Love Soft as an easy chair. Yeah, that's my impression. The album cover from the 70s, A Star Is Born, now we're to like, what, to the third version of at least. It was the one that came out with Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. Was that the third or the fourth one?
That might have been the fourth.
Yeah, well, anyway, this was the one from the 70s, and the album cover just creeps me out because I do not need to see either Kris Kristofferson or Barbara Streisand in any state of undress, and they're both in a state of undress on the album cover, and it's not cool. But
pretty much.
I get all of Streisand's late 70s songs mixed up. Like, I guess she kind of had her own soft rock sound. It was very lush. I don't know if that's good, I guess. She kind of broke out of that when she teamed up with the Bee Gees, you know, in 1980, but they all kind of sound the same. And this one's right in that wheelhouse. They're not actually, they're kind of ethereal in a way. I don't know if they're good, but they're like, they do have their sound all their own. They kind of float up into the air.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, definitely.
Because I listen to the Star Is Born soundtrack all the time. I'm all over it.
So, yes.
Anyway, as I lose my place here, next for you is Prove It at number 28 by Television.
These guys, early New York CBGB's punk band, extremely influential, and they're hyped up quite a bit by the NME, New Musical Express of the UK, which is pretty much all that magazine does. But that led to their success in the UK. Didn't have any success at all in the US. Actually, the only time that any members of Television made the charts in the U.S. were once they left Television. Their drummer made it as a member of the Waitresses. And Richard Lloyd, the guitarist, made it on the charts as a sideman for Matthew Sweet. But anyway, they made it onto the U.K. charts twice, with this one and with Marquee Moon, the title track, which is one of my favorite songs of all time, which,
yeah, it's a good song.
Kind of amazing that was even released as a single because it's 10 minutes long. But this song is, Prove It's kind of a weird choice for a single too. It's kind of vaguely reggae, I guess would be the best way to describe it. And I mean, if I had to pick two singles off this album, I mean, both of these songs, I mean, both this and Marquee Moon are decent, but I think Venus or Guiding Light, which is kind of a ballad, probably would have done better on the charts, kind of fit in better. They're more pop songs, but this is decent. And the single cover for this is pretty funny, too, because their record label, for some reason, decided to put like a, almost like a speech bubble on it, and it said punk rock and
weasel
capital letters and like an exclamation point. But yeah, I mean, shocked to see that these guys on any charts.
Yeah, it's pretty cool though, because I like Television too, and they but yeah, they don't strike me as like a band that like anybody but like dorks like us would like, basically. So
Pretty much. Yeah, exactly.
It's not like you can go get a date. Hey, I'm into Television. Ooh, I want to do you.
Okay.
Well, I'm just saying, okay. You know, it's not like they're, you know, hey, let's go to the Television. That's probably a better way to put it. Let's go to the Television concert. Ooh, can we? And they're good. I mean, don't get me wrong. And, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm just saying a lot of bands that are good aren't popular. So that's my
that's true.
Long way around to get to a point. So
yeah, but 27 for you, and we get the Bee Gees, or a cover of the Bee Gees again. Candy Staton with Nights on Broadway.
Yeah, but this is good shit. This is funky, it's soulful, and Staton can, and the way I wrote this was when I was preparing my notes, I put, and Staton can sing both Robin and Barry Gibb's parts with verve.
Okay.
Staten is best known here in the United States for Young Hearts Run Free, which came out about a year before this, but most of her hits were in the UK. But this is really good. Did you listen to this one?
I did. Yeah, it's a good cover.
It's a legit cover. It's very good. And that wouldn't be an easy song to cover because you have two vocalists singing it in the Bee Gees version. So that's probably the one where Robin is most prominent in the late Bee Gees period because he sings the bridge basically. So, but she hits them both.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she knocked it out of the park. It's a really good song.
She did. Yeah, it's a really good version. And this is actually the Bee Gees version is probably my favorite song of theirs from this era too.
Yeah, it is
the disco era.
Really good. So,
yeah.
Next up for you, though, number 26, I Knew the Bride by Dave Edmunds.
The song's credited to Dave Edmunds, but this is actually Rockpile. And Rockpile were led by Edmunds and Nick Lowe, but due to the fact that they were signed to different labels as solo artists, they couldn't put out material as a band. So they kind of released half of their stuff as Dave Edmunds and half of their stuff as Nick Lowe, and like the other guys at Rockpile would be like the backing band on those albums. And Nick Lowe actually wrote this one, but since rockabilly was kind of more in Dave Edmunds' wheelhouse, it kind of ended up going to him. And the song's essentially a rewrite of Chuck Berry's You Never Can Tell. And in it, Edmunds is a guest at a wedding and he's kind of describing a traditional wedding and how the bride ended up with a boring guy with a steady job. And he's kind of remembering how she was a few years back when she was out every night getting wild with the rockabilly dudes. And that's basically the gist of the song. And Lowe put out his own version in the 80s and he was backed up by Huey Lewis and the News on it. And that version actually charted in the States, too. Didn't make it to the top 40, but it did make it to the Hot 100. And it's been covered a few times. Dion covered it. The Knack covered it. Status Quo covered it. So kind of one of Dave Edmunds' signature songs. Pretty decent for a like rockabilly revival song. So.
This is the second week in a row we've had a Dave Edmunds song on here.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Queen of Hearts.
Yeah, yeah. Which would have been the original, I think, may have been on the same album as this too.
Yeah, probably.
Yep. But moving on to 25 for you, Barry Biggs with Three Ring Circus.
I finally have a skip. And this is a really bizarre kind of soft rock reggae cover of a Blue Magic song. So I'm skipping it. It was weird, but it's not worth talking about.
Okay. Okay.
Number 24 for you is Show You the Way to Go by the Jacksons.
This is straight up Philly soul from the Jacksons, which is kind of odd for them, really. Sounds like Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes with Michael Jackson on lead vocals. It's a good song, but it's just weird for them because they never really went in this direction. Basically just like stopped here. It's like if you like went back and like found a fossil of like a human being with like a tail or something like that. Just kind of like a weird evolutionary mishap. That's interesting.
I like zoned out there for a second. I'm like, is he talking about human beings with tails?
Yes, in relation to Michael Jackson.
Yeah,
but it's a decent song, and it was actually the biggest hit for the Jacksons or the Jackson 5 in the UK.
Huh. That's weird.
Their only number one hit in the UK. But not as successful in the U.S., only made it to 28 over there. But decent song, kind of interesting, forgotten direction for the Jacksons there.
Speaking of human freaks, has anybody ever been actually born as a Cyclops before? That had to have happened.
I'm pretty sure it had. I mean, it had to have happened.
Yeah, I know.
At some point. Maybe not like the eye in the middle of the head, but...
Like the dude from Crawl or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Like a big giant Cyclops, and he can take out the berserkers or whatever the hell those things are. That's not what they're called.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing, I mean, I remember, like, there being, like, a giant spider in that movie.
There was.
If I remember correctly.
There's lots of cool stuff in that movie.
Yes, yeah. But anyway, number 23 for you is Queen with good old-fashioned Lover Boy.
This is another skip because I'm sick and tired of talking about Queen, and I keep getting mediocre Queen songs every time. I get nothing but the bullshit from Queen. So I'm skipping it. I'd just be running over, you know, old ground. So number 22 for you is All Around the World by The Jam.
This isn't one of my favorite Jam singles. It's, I mean, pretty typical of early Jam. I mean, it's good, but I mean, it's just kind of there. Paul Weller and Bruce Foxton kind of do like call and response vocals in this. And it's sort of an answer song to like the rest of UK punk. They're saying that they want a new direction and a youth explosion, but they also say, what's the point of saying destroy? So kind of attacking, I guess, anarchy in the UK because the Sex Pistols say destroy at the end of that.
Yeah.
But what's weird about this is that these guys were Mod Revival, and the revival didn't really happen that far after the actual Mods disappeared. It was only like 10 years or so. Be like, if somebody, I forget, I mean, having a hard time remembering trends from like 2010, but it's like if somebody like brought that back now, like auto-tune rap or something like that.
Early Katy Perry?
Pretty much, yeah. But that's kind of what's happening here. And I did find one funny clip of them on the Mark Boland show performing this. And they get like a really flamboyant intro by Mark Boland, and he's wearing like a leopard print jumpsuits, and he's like, these guys are what happening now, Jam. but and then you contrast that with the Jam when they pop out and they're wearing like matching suits.
Yeah,
so yeah, but good band, but the song isn't that great. So
yeah, I would agree with you. The two songs that came out, the two singles they released between this song, In the City came out before this, which is a pretty great song.
Right.
And the other one was...
this is the Modern
World. Modern World, right. Yeah, so
yeah,
both superior songs to this one pretty easily. But
oh, yeah, definitely, especially In the City.
Yeah, In the City's a good song. So, but yeah, but I enjoy the Jam. They definitely evolved quite a bit over their, you know, by the end of their period, they were almost like a soul band, basically. But, you know.
Yeah, and Weller pretty much went full into that when he started the Style Council, too.
Yeah, so.
But 21 for you is Jonathan Richman with Roadrunner.
Well, this song sounds like what it would happen if John Cale from the Velvet Underground decided to rock out, which makes sense, since he produced an early version of this song, and it is a tribute to the Velvet Underground's Sister Ray. And it does, if you know that song, it does bear quite a lot of similarities to it. There's several versions of this song that Richman recorded. I'm pretty sure the version that charted in the UK was credited to the Modern Lovers, which is the band he was in, but Greg Kinband may have played background actually on it instead of the Modern Lovers. So it's hard to tell. I think that's what I read was that version that actually charted in the UK, but it's the one that you've probably most commonly heard. And it's odd because even name checks the Modern Lovers in the song, but you know, I can understand why this was grouped in with punk. although I'm not really sure it's actually punk. It's more, I don't know how you describe it. Maybe alternative before alternative existed, maybe a little bit. It definitely is kind of unique and
almost garage rock too,
I suppose. Yeah, like a avant-garde garage, probably, I guess. But it rocks and it's a good song. And Jonathan Richmond, you know, was pretty influential. The Modern Lovers were as well. So, but a good song.
Yeah, and actually, from what I've heard, Jonathan Richmond doesn't like the song, though. He, like, refuses to play it.
Yeah, well, you know, nowadays, Jonathan Richmond, you know, the last time I remember seeing him was in, you know, this is 20 years ago now, it was in There's Something About Mary. I don't know what the hell he's doing these days, but...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's probably what most people know him for, actually.
Oh, I'm sure. Without doubt. But let's stop talking about him, Matt, because your next song at number 20 is one that everybody knows, The Crunch by Ra Band.
This is a skip for me. It's kind of... I don't know. It's like almost Gary Glitter with... Gary Glitter instrumental, I guess, would be the best way to describe it.
I just wanted to make a Captain Crunch references. Can you just help a brother out, literally?
Sure. Make all the references you want here.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you prefer regular Captain Crunch or Crunch Berries?
Probably Crunch Berries.
Yeah, I hear you. I agree.
They're both good. I mean, actually, I haven't bought Captain Crunch in a long time. So
neither. Well, I bought it for the kids, but I haven't. I may have had a bowl of it like within the last year, though. Crunchberry. Once in a while, I get the need. So
yeah.
But I also believe this leads us to your long distance dedication.
It does. So at number 49 here, we have the absolute king of the British charts, Cliff Richard with When Worlds Drift Apart. This guy had...
So you and 14... I had... We had Cliff Richard and Connie Francis in our long distance dedication.
No, I know. But anyway, this guy had 14 number one hits, 69 top tens, 123 top 40 hits, stretching from 1958 to 2009. He even had three songs that were below the top 40 in the 2010s. He still hasn't charted in this decade, but he's still somewhat young for a person who was putting out singles in the 50s. He's only 79, so it could happen, theoretically.
Yeah, it could. I didn't realize he was that young, so...
Right. And in that same time period, he only had six top 40 hits, period, in the U.S. Two of them were pretty big hits, Devil Woman and It's So Funny We Don't Talk Anymore. But whatever he was doing at his peak in the 60s didn't translate here. All those hits came like after his peak period in the U.K. But... My introduction to him was through the TV show The Young Ones, British comedy show in the early 80s, and it took its name and the theme song from Cliff Richard's The Young Ones. And it was kind of a running joke on the show that the character Rick, who was a wannabe anarchist, was also a Cliff Richard super fan. And Cliff Richard even figured into the final scene of the series because the Young Ones crashed through a Cliff Richard billboard in a double-decker bus before crashing off an actual cliff. But one of his number one hits actually featured the Young Ones on background vocals. But anyway, this song, it's a soft ballad. It has Cliff backed with a piano and a string section. It's pretty boring. It only peaked at number 46, so relative failure for Cliff. But giving it up to Cliff Richard for dominating the British charts.
He's also one of the first artists to ever be played on MTV because We Don't Talk Anymore, I think it was like one of the first 10 videos shown on MTV. I'm not sure where it is in the order. It wasn't first or second, but it was right there.
I think you're definitely right about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, and that song's okay. It's all right.
That one's decent. Devil Woman's decent, all right, too.
You know.
Yeah.
Disco Cliff a little bit. So, or well, not disco, but they're okay. Right. We got our little morsel. It was like tea. You know, the British love tea, and Americans kind of like tea, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I actually don't mind tea these days. I don't really ever have it, but I could. That's the one hot drink I will drink, believe it or not.
I prefer iced tea to hot tea.
See, but that's the other exception. Normally, I like cold drinks, and iced tea can, you know, can go to hell, basically.
Okay.
To the degree I feel strongly about iced tea at all.
Yeah, exactly. At number 19 here, we have the Stranglers again with Peaches.
Well, because I've already had the Stranglers, I'm going to reluctantly skip this one.
Okay.
On to number 18, It's Your Life by Smokey.
This is skip for... The lead singer of Smokey sounds like Rod Stewart, and he had a big hit duet with Suzy Quatro. That's pretty much all you need to know about him.
Okay, I was wondering who that dude was.
Yeah, yep. Chris Norman was the guy's name.
Stumbling In, right?
Yes. But number 17 is Tavares with One Step Away.
Well, the skips are coming fast and furious. I'm skipping this because even though Tavares has their charms, if you've heard one of their songs, you've pretty much heard all their songs. So I'm not going to roll.
Pretty much.
Yeah, they're pretty samey sounding. Next up for you, number 16, Float On by the Floaters.
Yes, Aquarius, Libra, Leo, Cancer, Ralph, Charles, Paul, Larry. That's the intro to the song, obviously. And the song is basically, I mean, each verse of the song, each one of the floaters gets a verse where they color their zodiac sign and they say what they want in a woman. Ralph wants a woman who can hold her own and likes her freedom. Charles wants a quiet woman who carries herself like Miss Universe. Paul says that he likes all women because they're wildflowers. And Larry wants a woman who loves everything and everybody. Smooth, soft soul. The album version of it's almost 12 minutes long. The first 7 minutes or so are almost instrumental, and it sounds basically exactly what Todd was doing in the intro. And only hit in the UK. What?
I hope not, because I sound like shit.
Well, I mean, you got the basic feel of it, but this was their only big hit in the UK or the US, kind of a cross Atlantic one hit wonder. Made it to number one here, number two in the US. And Cheech and Chong did like a proto Weird Al parody of it called Bloat On.
Yep, I've heard that.
And it's about eating too much, and they do the intros too. So it's hamburger, my name is Big Boy, and ice cream, my name is Sugar, stuff like that. But decent song, and I've mentioned on other episodes that there's always one song that gets stuck in my head, and this is the one this week.
Ooh, so. I don't know if that's a good thing. I'm big into 70s soul, but I've never been able to get into this song for some reason. It's just too, it is unique, but it has too little to it.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, pretty much. Yeah.
Plus, I find people who are into like the zodiac and all that like weird.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I basically know my zodiac sign, but know like absolutely nothing about like the characteristics of it or take it seriously at all.
So. You know what my zodiac sign is? Do you even know?
Leo, I'm guessing.
No.
Cancer.
Cancer. Okay. People like to use profanity a lot.
Yes, yes.
I don't even know what yours is, and I should because my daughter is born the day before you.
Aries.
That might be.
I'm an Aries.
You're an Aries. So. Yeah. So I've always thought people who are like way into the zodiac were just weirdos.
Yeah, kind of. But number 15 for you is Shawadi Wadi with You Got What It Takes.
First of all, I just noticed this looking at this. This thing was a huge hit. This jumped from number 50 to number 15 on the chart. So holy mackerel. Big jump for Shawadi Wadi. I've had them before and I skipped them, I think, last time I had them. But I'm keeping them this time because they were definitely just remake revivalists. But this song isn't too bad at all. It sounds like a 50s song if it were done by like the Bay City Rollers. It's like a stomper. And it's kind of a stomper and also a little bit Northern Soul-ish, which I guess makes sense. And the video I saw of this, they were on the German show Musikladen, which a lot of videos from the 70s come from. And this is the rare Musikladen video from the late 70s that doesn't have any nudity in it. Have you ever watched like clips from Musikladen from that period? They just threw in random nudity into songs that had nothing to do with nudity whatsoever. It was like the softcore period of Germany.
Oh yeah. I've definitely noticed that too.
For Jeans On by who is that? By David Dundas, I think.
Yeah, David Dundas.
That is like basically softcore porn and David Dundas has nothing to do with it. I mean, they just have this clip of a naked woman taking her jeans on and off.
Okay.
That's pretty awesome, actually. But
yeah.
But this Shawadi Wadi song, actually, it's really pretty good, honestly. I can understand why I jumped 35 spots on the chart this week. So,
right.
I'll give them their due.
These guys were kind of like rockers. Do you think they ever like got into any battles with the Jam because they're mods?
Possibly. Maybe that's what Pete Townsend wrote Quadrophenia about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. Another iconic song, number 14, is Exodus by Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Movement of the people.
Yeah.
Obviously based on the book of Exodus, and instead of Moses leading his people out of Egypt, you get Jah leading the Rastas out of Babylon. And due to the fact that they practically gave copies of Legend out to every college student in the 90s,
yeah.
I've probably heard this song about as many times as I've heard Fleetwood Mac's Dreams. Mind you, it's not as overplayed as something like Buffalo Soldier or something like that. But I've always thought it was weird that like what was probably intended as gospel music for Rastafarians ended up becoming party music for a bunch of white kids.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, and it's party music. I don't know if party music is the right way to put it. It was like smoking weed music is more accurate, probably.
Pretty much.
Not
yeah.
I would know, but
yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, that's kind of come up as a joke, like in various sources, like in the past. Like, there's an Onion article, Bob Marley rises from the grave to free frat boys from oppression.
Yeah.
The Saturday Night Live skit, Are You There, John? It's me, Roz Trent. Yeah. Which is actually the last great Saturday Night Live bit where Andy Samberg's pretending to be a Rasta.
I don't think I've seen that one. I need to go check that out.
You should check that out. It's pretty good. And also, he probably inspired the weed church here in Madison that closed down about a year ago. There was a couple white guys who were pretending to be Rastas, and they're giving away pot for $50 donations, claiming a religious exemption. But obviously they got shut down pretty quickly for doing that.
So what church do you go to now?
What?
What church do you go to now?
I don't go to one. But anyway, this song's... Exodus is a decent song. And
it's a good song. This is the song you would not hear necessarily at the frat party because it's too hardcore. It's not like Three Little Birds or... happy music that you can, frankly,
like jamming or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah,
you could always tell the difference between the poser Bob Marley fans, which pretty much everybody starts out as, including myself, and the more serious Bob Marley fans based on whether you had just or if you actually delved into a couple of albums or not. That's always the tell with Bob Marley.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely.
I do have a couple of his albums, so for what it's worth.
Yeah, I think I inherited like two of his albums, but yeah.
Right. But... So, or the alternate of that is does the person who says they love reggae only have Bob Marley albums and not anything by anybody else? So like...
Right.
If you have somebody who has a Toots and the Maytals album or even like a Peter Tosh solo album, then you know you're dealing with somebody a little bit more seriously into reggae.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And what if they only have like dub albums?
Well, but that came after reggae. I mean, then they're weird. But and then if you have somebody who has something like Burning Spear, then you know they're deep into reggae.
Yeah, yeah.
Burning exactly. Spear is good. I was actually listening to Burning Spear like two nights ago.
Hmm. Yeah, they're pretty good.
They're very good.
Yeah. But the next one, pretty far from reggae on this one. Olivia Newton-John with Sam.
This is a skip because she did not write this song about getting Ja out of Babylon. It's just
it'd be funny if Olivia do that.
Well, she did
like take just had like a reggae period.
She took a lot of different stylistic directions. I mean, it's conceivable she could have gone down that road. I mean, a lot of rock artists did, so why not?
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
It would have been better if they would have done a reggae version of Grease. I would watch that.
Oh, just like the cast where it's like basically like a reggae movie.
Yeah, they should do a mashup of The Harder They Come and Grease. That'd be awesome.
It'd be interesting.
In a way, The Harder They Come is kind of like Grease, sort of. Because he starts out, you know, Jimmy Cliff's character in that, he's a little bit hardcore, I guess, when he gets to Kingston. But, you know, he's still trying to stay on the straight and narrow. And he does a lot of the shit he does in the movie to impress the woman, right? I mean, that's not his whole motivation, but that's part of it. Or the frustration that he got shunned by the preacher in the middle of the movie, you know, and mm-hmm. basically gives up and becomes, whatever the hell his name was.
Right.
I don't remember. Before I go on these tangents, I should really research my tangents before I go on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen
it. I only saw it like a month or two ago. It was on TCM. So, in fact, it may even be on my DVR right now as I speak. I could have been watching The Harder They Come as I did this rant.
Right, right.
That is a great. The movie itself is uneven, but that is a great soundtrack to the movie.
It is. Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, number 12 is Feel the Need by the Detroit Emeralds.
This is a skip. It's not too bad, but I just needed something to skip here.
Fair enough.
Yep. Number 11 for you is John Miles with Slow Down.
Get on with your bad self, John Miles, because this sounds like a mashup of Shaft and Hot Chocolate, which is not a bad thing. This is actually a really cool song. It's produced by Rupert Pina Colada song Him Holmes as well.
Nice.
It made it to number 34 in the US, but I'll be damned if I've ever heard this song one single time ever. on like a
neither have I.
Never heard it on a 70s channel. I've never heard it on a funk channel because he's probably because he's white. But so he's going along with this funky ass groove and all that, and then just effortlessly throws in some disco talk box in the middle of the song. And it is glorious as hell, I'm telling you. So this song is really cool. I don't know why it's not better remembered. It would be a perfect song that somebody will get people to remember if they like. I could see Tarantino putting this in a movie or something, or Guy Ritchie or somebody like that. And it'd probably be more Guy Ritchie.
Yeah.
Although Guy Ritchie doesn't really make those kind of Tarantino ripoff movies anymore, but if he did, I could see him throwing this song in there, like if it was about like a punk heist movie. The punk version of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. That's what Guy Ritchie should do.
Right.
But no, but it is. It's actually a really cool song, believe it or not. It's my surprise for this chart.
I listened to it too. It's pretty decent.
The talk, but disco talk box. That might be the first talk box I've ever heard in a disco song. It's cool.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I can't think of any other examples. I'm assuming there are some.
They're probably.
Yeah. But
anyway, a much better known song for you at number 10 is Easy by the Commodores.
This is the best Lionel Richie or Commodore song, hands down. Always really like this one. Actually, the guitar solo on this is probably one of my favorite guitar solos ever. Just fuzzed out, just like really fierce for a ballad like this. But song's about a breakup. Lionel's planning on dumping his girlfriend, but he's not sad about it. He's free. He doesn't have to fake it anymore. He's easy like Sunday morning. And since I mentioned the guitar solo, the build up to the guitar solo is also great, where just kind of like everything drops out and Lionel shouts out, ooh!
Yep.
But
I also like in the middle of the guitar solo how like they actually screw up on the drums. The beat goes out of whack for a second, but it's one of those songs where they kept it in, and it's good that they did because it makes it actually kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know what you're talking about there. And the song was actually very faithfully covered by Faith No More in the early 90s. And their version was actually a bigger hit on the UK charts, believe it or not. Commodores made it up to number 9. Faith No More made it up to number 3 in the UK. So, but
you know, I've heard that version.
Kind of surprised by that. But
it seemed like it was faithful at the time, but then you listen to it now, and they do try to do it, but they were trying to be ironic about it because it was like, oh, check it out, it's the Commodores. And you know, at the time, it sort of made sense, I guess, but, you know, now it's like,
right.
I think people.
Yeah, and they also did that with I Started a Joke, too.
Yeah, and I think now, because people, you know, that came out before the 70s revival, really, and now people like it on its own terms, so I don't know that Faith No More version aged quite as well. Although you're right, they did basically try to do a faithful version of it. So,
yeah,
but you're right, the guitar solo is pretty cool. I don't know if it's one of my favorite ones, but it's unique for a soul song, that's for sure. And the thing you're talking about where it is pretty, you know, for a ballad is a pretty hard guitar solo. In that sense, it's a lot like the album version of Let It Be in the sense. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, you're right about
but
that.
But in terms of the tempo of the song, it's a lot like it's a mid-tempo song in a good way, like Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye. It's that same kind of, you know, it's not slow, but it's not fast. It's perfect right in the middle.
Yeah. But let's see. Number 9 for you, and this cover of a song by a UW Madison alum, Rita Coolidge with We're All Alone.
I didn't know that that Trent Jackson ever did any music. But anyway, this is a shitty cover of a Boz Scaggs original, the actual Graduate Matt's talking about. Rita Coolidge, who, you know, kind of, she was sort of she floated around. She was with Kris Kristofferson, so that didn't hurt her cause. And so she was floating around the music scene. I think she was, wasn't she in Delaney and Friends for a little bit, I think.
She was in like Joe Cocker's band.
Yeah.
I think.
So she was floating around the celebrity scene, and you know, she was in movies. She was in Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. She's in that movie. You know, kind of, you know, a good artist, but her best, her biggest two hits are just horrific covers of songs. This one and Jackie Wilson's Higher and Higher, which she somehow manages to slow to a crawl. It's like it's awful. And it's weird because she does have a pretty voice. I actually don't hate All Time High from Octopussy, which she did, you know, about 5 years later. But
right.
But you know, come on. I mean, Boz Scaggs absolutely knocked this one out of the park on the Silk Degrees album. And
oh yeah, yeah.
And this is like a 4-3 ground out. I mean, it's not like she didn't sing it well. It's just doesn't have anywhere near the feeling that Boz's version does. And the only cool thing I will say about this version is it does have the squelched out synthesizer like in the verses, which is very of its time. But
right,
you know, but in her defense, I will say this, the smooth and yet strained way that Boz actually sings that song on Silk Degrees would be very hard to cover by anybody. That's the range on his voice is really strange even for Boz on that particular song. So I'll give her that. That would be a difficult song to cover, but you know, this isn't in his league, not even close.
Right. And I should mention that the Silk Degrees album is awesome.
It is very awesome. Anyway, for you, number 8 is Oh Lori by Alessi.
Easy listening would be the best way to describe this. Definitely in the same genre as like Barry Manilow or the Carpenters. Kind of like old timey and with like falsettos. The guys in Alessi were identical twins. They were named Bobby and Billy Alessi. And they were on Broadway before this, and they're kind of in like a minor band called Barnaby Bye. But this was their only hit in the UK. Didn't chart at all in the US. They actually wouldn't have a Hot 100 appearance for another few years after this. They had like one in 1982 out of nowhere. But after they were done with their career as singers, they became jingle writers. And they wrote jingles for Ford, Twix, Slim Fast, Diet Coke, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Sears, Dr. Pepper, Greyhound, Lifesavers, and Blockbuster Video.
Did they create Be a Pepper?
No. This was after Be a Pepper. This was like whatever Dr. Pepper's jingle was in the mid-80s. And the Lifesavers ad was the one with Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
Okay, so, I don't remember.
So they wrote that. And they're also members of the Long Island Music Hall of Fame.
Ooh.
And in their induction class, kind of a callback to your long distance dedication, Connie Stevens, the Lovin' Spoonful, Salt and Peppa, Taylor Dane, and Houdini. So,
okay.
And they're inducted 6 years before Bowser from Shawna. So they got that going.
Bowser didn't really deserve to be a first ballot Long Island Music Hall of Fame member. Let's be honest.
Right. And well, he was actually inducted by himself without Shawna too, which okay. is kind of hilarious. not a great song by any means.
I'm not going to play it, but I have a 1985 Dr. Pepper commercial queued up on YouTube right now. And it was Dr. Pepper made a pepper out of me. I remember that song. So maybe Alessi wrote that.
Could have been theirs.
But
yeah,
be honest, yeah. This would have been a skip if it would have been outside of the top 10.
Probably. Yeah.
But see, then we would have never learned that. That's the beauty of not having any top 10 skips. Right, plus, I wouldn't be able to make this dumbass joke I'm about to make that they didn't allow Jean Alesi to be in the band.
It's number seven for you is Gladys Knight and the Pips with Baby Don't Change Your Mind.
This is written by Van McCoy, and it sounds a lot like it because let's be honest, Gladys and the Pips were trying to stay relevant at this point. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people would guess this, but Gladys Knight and the Pips did not have a top 40 hit in the United States after 1975.
Hmm.
And, which is weird because, I mean, I'm old enough to remember about half the 70s, and they were on TV quite a bit back in those days. I remember, I knew who Gladys Knight was. Now, our mom listened to her a lot, so that was part of it, but she was also on TV plenty. I mean, it's not like I didn't get to see her in other venues. And conversely, in the UK, they had 7 top 40 UK hits after their last US one. This was their biggest one. It got up to number 4. And to be perfectly honest, it's pretty mediocre.
Yeah.
I like Gladys Knight and the Pips, but this one's not that great. I mean, even by Van McCoy standards, it's not even that great.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, it is just kind of there.
I believe it was in the U.S. Hot 100, but I don't know. It never got into the top 40. So, anyway, switching gears quite a bit here. Number 6 is Pretty Vacant by the Sex Pistols again.
If I had to pick a favorite Sex Pistols song, it would probably be this. It definitely rocks.
Definitely rocks.
The most out of any of their songs. And it was one of the band's first original compositions. Glenn Matlock, who was the original bass player for the Sex Pistols, was inspired to write the song after he heard Richard Hell's Blank Generation, which kind of covered the same theme of, like, which this is funny now because Richard Hell and the Sex Pistols were baby boomers. So they're kind of like talking about the baby boomers as just like the nowhere generation.
Yeah. Yep.
Like basically like idiots that you can push around. It's the chorus of it was inspired by by an article about the Bay City Rollers, which had a caption under their picture, which said, "They're so pretty." So kind of mixing Richard Hell and the Bay City Rollers, which honestly is a pretty good description of what the Sex Pistols were going for, or what Malcolm McLaren wanted them to go for. Just kind of like a punk boy band, basically. And supposedly he copied the riff from ABBA's SOS, but I don't really hear that at all. I don't know about you.
I've never even occurred to me until you just said that.
Yeah, I don't get it. But it was Rush released after God Save the Queen was up at the top of the charts because Malcolm McLaren wanted to kind of keep the momentum going. And they needed a single to promote in Europe because singing about Queen Elizabeth wouldn't, like, fly in, like, Germany or whatever. So they initially thought of going with Holidays in the Sun, but it wasn't ready. So they picked this because it was catchy. The band's fans already knew it. And because the lyrics weren't controversial, McLaren didn't want to get banned again. He just wanted a song out there that would just like shoot up the charts. And this did. So peaked at number 6, which it's here right now. And the single cover featured 2 buses on it, which had Nowhere and Boredom listed as their destinations. And that's kind of been like used over and over for like various Sex Pistols type stuff, like reissues or like bootlegs. And there was actually a pretty funny cover of this that came out a couple years after this by Paul Jones, who was the lead singer of Manfred Mann back in the 60s. And he did kind of like a jokey soft rock version of this. And the B-side was a jokey soft rock version of the Ramones' Sheena's a Punk Rocker. So just kind of like taking a swipe at Punk, jokey swipe at Punk at that. But in the research of this, I stumbled onto a clip of the Sex Pistols playing this on one of the reunions from like 10 years ago. And it was like disappointing because of how fat Johnny Rotten was. Apparently he's like ballooned in weight in the last 10 years or so. But also kind of pathetic seeing like a bunch of 60-year-old guys playing this, but great song.
So. Where did you hear it first?
Where did I hear this first? Oh God. If not on the album, it might have been because it was the theme song of the sketch show, The Vacant Lot.
I guarantee you that's where you heard it first.
Probably.
My favorite Sex Pistols song kind of floats around. I've actually kind of come into the Liar orbit in terms of one of my favorite songs. That song rocks.
It's okay. That's never been one of my favorites. No Feelings is good. I like 17 a lot. That's not one of most people's favorites.
You know what song of theirs that's overrated, but... though, is Anarchy in the UK. I think that song's overrated.
Yeah, you're right about that. I'm not really that big of a fan of Holidays in the Sun.
Yeah, I like Holidays in the Sun. That song's cool.
Yeah. But number five for you, we have Hot Chocolate with So You Win Again.
I love Hot Chocolate. Seriously, I really do. I've always loved this band. As long as I've had access to him anyway. Their lead singer is Errol Brown, and he's a legit great lead singer, and he wrote most of their songs. But who I really want to pay tribute to is one of their guitar players, Harvey Hinsley. And he's the one who created the sound of Hot Chocolate, because if you listen to their best known song here is
You Sexy Thing.
Sexy Thing, right. And then also The Almighty, Everyone's a Winner, which is one of my favorite songs.
Great song. Great song.
But all of their songs, and this song, So You Win Again, also has this weird kind of almost electronic soundy. It's kind of a guitar. It's kind of a synthesizer type thing. That was kind of their trademark sound. And Harvey Hinsley played that. And he played it through a guitar synthesizer. It was a very early prototype of that. So that's how they got that sound. And they were, most bands who used that were prog bands, but they were one of the very few hit making bands that actually used that instrument. So that's one thing that's interesting about them. They were also revolutionary in the UK because they were a multiracial band. They had a couple black guys and a couple white guys. And in the UK in the 70s, that was pretty revolutionary, because the UK is pretty backwards when it comes to racial relations. They're about at least 20 years behind us on a lot of that stuff. So that was a big deal
right
in the 70s in the UK. But they were cool. They were rock disco, and they were also funk, and in a way that I don't think many other bands replicated. I mean, they weren't, you know, it's not like they were funkadelic where they were hard rock with funk elements. They were kind of their own thing. They were definitely a pop band as well. So This made it to number 31 in the US, but, you know, as mentioned, You Sexy Thing and Everyone's a Winner were their two big ones. You Sexy Thing came out before this. Everyone's a Winner came out after this, but, And you can hear the best example of that guitar synthesizer is on the playout of the longer version of Everyone's a Winner, where he's playing his guitar so hard, it like loses the synthesizer effect on it. And then it like fades out. The tone of it fades out a couple times, but it's cool because it's, you know, it rocks, but
it does. Yeah.
I don't think any band in funk or rock ever used that quite as a primary instrument, quite like Hot Chocolate did. So I think it's cool. And most of their soul songs are also really cool. That's the Errol Brown influence, but one of my favorite bands. I really enjoy them.
Yeah, I like this song, and I mean the other two songs that we mentioned too. I mean, especially Everyone's a Winner. That's a really, really great song.
Heaven's in the Backseat of My Cadillac is a lot like Everyone's a Winner and equally cool. And it has strings in it too. It has like Monday Night Football strings, 70s strings. Go check that one out. That's a good song too. But they also did the original Brother, or the original Brother Louie by Stories. They did.
Oh, okay, okay, they did
the original of that in the early in their career. So, super cool band.
Yeah. Yep.
A weird one popping up at number four. Wouldn't expect to see them is Angelo by Brotherhood of Man.
This is a straight up ABBA ripoff. The songwriter and Brother of Man member Lee Sheridan like denies the similarities to ABBA. Says that he was just writing in the style of the time, but with the female harmonies, the tinkling like Waterloo Dancing Queen piano riff, and like the Fernando style chorus, I mean, it's hard to say that it's not ABBA. I mean, you knew what you were doing when you wrote this song. Come on. And
that sounds like Charlie Murphy talking about Prince in the Chappelle show. You know what you were doing when you put that outfit on.
Yeah, kind of. The song tells the story about a doomed relationship between a Mexican shepherd boy named Angelo and an unnamed daughter of a wealthy man. Spoilers, they commit suicide because they can't be together. So, obviously, Romeo and Juliet was as much of an influence as ABBA there. And I actually went and watched the Top of the Pops clip, and it made it even worse because they actually look like ABBA. I mean, kind of dopey looking guys, and then like one blonde and one brunette. So, I mean, this is ABBA. I mean, they should just call it ABBA.
So, be honest, you would have skipped this one too if it wasn't in the top 10, right?
Maybe. I might have just ripped on them for ripping off ABBA. So,
Who do you think would win in a fight between Angelo and Fernando?
Probably Fernando, I'm guessing.
Probably.
Because wasn't Fernando a soldier, if I remember correctly?
I don't remember. The only song I can think of right now is Summer Night City for some reason. Which is their tribute to Stockholm. That song rules. You should go listen to that too.
Right. But anyway, switching gears again here, we have Everson, Lake, and Palmer with Fanfare for the Common Man.
Yeah, I wonder if ELP in the summer of 77, when they were supposedly the dinosaurs sent to extinction by punk rock, I wonder if they sat back Prince style in the Chappelle show, second reference I made to that, in the True Hollywood Story sketch, and just sat back and said, bitches, when they were higher on the chart than any punk artist on here. They're three ahead of the closest punk artist, but this is a sort of a cover of the Aaron Copland orchestral classic. And Aaron Copland was still alive when this was made, and he actually had to give them permission to record it. And they sent him a recording of this, and it's, you know, it does bear elements, you know, it has the that part, which is famous from that Copland composition, but then it trails off into all kinds of prog instrumentalization. But Aaron Copland dug it, so he actually gave them permission to record it, which he didn't give permission to many artists to record any of his stuff at that point. So ELP got DAP from Aaron Copland, but the video is bombastic and dated as you'd expect an ELP video to be. They're actually playing in an empty and snow-covered Olympic Stadium in Montreal.
Ooh, the Big O.
The Big O, which this was in the period where I suppose the Big O had like its one or two years where it was considered cool. And it's kind of a tribute to the 76 Olympics after the fact. I'm not really sure what made the 76 Olympics so iconic that it would need a tribute, but like they have the 76 Olympics logo on the Big O scoreboard, which to my knowledge, they never replaced. I think it was there when I went there, but the funny part of it to me was that they recorded it. They had their stage set up down what I think was the left field line for the baseball field. And I made one trip to the Big O the last year of the Expos, and The one thing I remember about going to that part of the Big O was, I mean, there couldn't have been more than 15,000 people there. And the only reason they had that many is because the Mets were playing. And so there were full sections. It was like old Cleveland Stadium. There were full sections of that were empty. And I took my then toddler daughter over there in the open spaces just to let her, you know, run around a little bit. And she methodically flipped over like two rows of seats in that part of the stadium. So that's my memory of the Big O. But by ELP standards, the song actually isn't that bad, but it's, you know, it's ELP.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
probably not as boring as like Lucky Man or whatever.
No, it's better than that, but it's still, you know, it trails on and on forever. I think Aaron Copland just got bored and just gave him approval so they wouldn't bother him anymore.
Right.
That's my theory. But anyway, for you, number two, Ma Baker by the almighty Boney M.
Yes. And this is based on the story of Ma Barker. They changed it to Baker in the song because it sounded better. Ma Barker's legendary Depression-era outlaw. And Ma Barker and her sons were probably mean cats, like they say in the song. But they weren't from Chicago. They were originally from Tulsa, and they operated out of St. Paul. They actually made a point of avoiding Chicago because they didn't want to run afoul of Al Capone. And there was some dispute over how involved with the gang she was in the first place. She was made out to be the mastermind by the FBI at the time and in the song. But there's some evidence that her sons were just kind of dragging her along so they could pose as a family on vacation just to dupe like motel owners and dumb cops when they were on the run. So that part, they got those parts wrong, but she was gunned down by the FBI. Boney M did get that part right. And it's pretty dumb, fun disco, like most of Boney M's tracks. The ma-ma-ma-ma part in the chorus was later copied by Lady Gaga for her song Poker Face. And there was actually a real video for this, too. Boney M are kind of like posing around an old 30s car, pretending to be Ma Baker's gang. And the guy for Boney M, he's like carrying around a Tommy gun and he has a cigar in his mouth. So kind of like playing up the gangster thing, but also like dressed up in like weird disco outfits at the same time. But it's a pretty enjoyable song. I mean, most of Boney M stuff is pretty enjoyable, just dumb fun stuff. So
I'm sitting here so pissed off at you right now, I can't even barely talk.
Why?
Because I don't really think you should be calling into question Boney M's chops when it comes to telling history, because I've heard Rasputin and that song is pretty goddamn accurate. So
Rasputin is pretty accurate, and there's actually a weird coincidence about that song too. When I was looking at the research, I was looking up the various members of Boney M, and I found out that the lead singer of the guy from Boney M died in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Yep.
On the exact same date that Rasputin died.
Yep. Yeah.
So that. weird coincidence not, there.
And you should preface that by saying not even the real lead singer, the lead singer they used live and who didn't generally sing on the records.
Right.
Boney M are hilarious because they're just weird. I mean, they're Euro disco, which makes them an outlier in the first place. And then the women who sing in it were originally from the West Indies and they emigrated to Germany. So
yeah,
they're like Caribbean German weirdness. And a lot of it was all made up in the first place because they were like the Milli Vanilli of the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, Frank Farian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same guy behind both bands.
But they told great stories, and I can't believe you're calling their their credentials as historians into question. I don't even know. I don't even know if I can do number one. That's just horrible. I like Rasputin a lot better than this song, but this, you're right. Their songs are enjoyable to listen to. They're dumb.
Definitely.
They're dumb, but they're enjoyable. And Rasputin really was Russia's greatest love machine. Just so I don't know.
I don't know
that there's any disputing that. I don't even know who else would be in his class.
Yeah. I can't think of anybody who would compete with him. So.
Maybe Pavel Bure.
Maybe.
Yakov Smirnoff. I don't know.
Right. But anyway, we're up to number one here.
We are.
So here we go. I Feel Love by Donna Summer.
Well, this is some pretty epic stuff by both Donna Summer and producer Giorgio Moroder. And in a weird way, I think this is a lot sexier, too, than the far more obviously blatantly sexual, you know, Love to Love You Baby, which came out a few years before this. And that's just a straight funk jam. But this song is pretty revolutionary. And both Summer and Moroder are amazing in this song. Summer had some serious range in her voice. I mean, she went from, you think about it, I mean, if you think about Hot Stuff, and that song is basically like a rock song that she sings in a lower register. I mean, you would never know if you didn't already know that Donna Summer also sang this song, which is pretty high falsetto, soprano, not falsetto. And, you know, she just has a great ability to create mood with her voice. She was really talented and, you know, deserved all the critical praise that she got both when she was recording and after. But what really makes this song revolutionary is what Moroder did with his synthesizers and, you know, this propulsive synthesizer sound that he basically created. And it's Eurodisco. It was recorded in Munich, but it may very well be the best Eurodisco song ever recorded. I mean, it went to number one in five countries. Yeah. It went to number six here in the United States. And the whole point of the song originally was to create a futuristic song, because the concept album that this came from had songs from different decades. So this was like the futuristic song added to that. And every bit of the song, except for the kick drum in it, is electronic. So that was, you know, apart from Kraftwerk, who, you know, did have, Autobahn was a hit, but, you know, they weren't anywhere near as well known as Donna Summer would have been. It was very revolutionary, and it definitely directly inspired Moroder's other big song, Chase, from the Midnight Express soundtrack, which the director of that movie said he wanted an I Feel Love like song for his soundtrack. So, super cool song. It's weird too, because it's very propulsive, but it's also slow too. It's not like it's kind of slow, but it's also, you could dance to it, I guess. So, really unique song. I don't know that there's another song quite like this one. It's, and it still sounds, you hear it today, and I would guarantee you that kids today would really enjoy that song too. Like, it sounds, he actually hit it. He actually did create a futuristic song, now that we're actually
future, obviously influenced a lot of like synth pop, and I think Kraftwerk, since you mentioned them, I think it like inspired some of their stuff too.
So super cool song. I mean, and Donna Summer, you know, like I said, she deserves all kinds of credit. She was a good muse for Giorgio Moroder and vice versa. So definitely one of the cooler songs of the late 70s. So, but
right,
that's it.
Yep. So what do you have for next
week? Are you ready for this?
Sure.
We are going to get out of our comfort zone. We are going to find out how fossilized we really are, because next week, Hot 100 from August 3rd, 2013.
August 3rd, 2013? Really?
Yeah, baby. We're going modern. We're going to do this one.
Wow.
We're doing this one for the kids. And we're going to find out, you and me both, I did recognize some of the songs on it, but just how I think it'll be fun, because either we're going to hate the hell out of it, or we're going to learn something?
Probably a little bit of both, I'm guessing.
Probably a little bit more of hate than learn, but there are a few songs I noticed in there that I didn't mind. So Kraft Punk is on there from the Eric Andre Show.
Oh, God.
You've been punk.
I'm assuming Daft Punk, not Kraft Punk.
No, it's Kraft Punk. So anyway, we are definitely going to get way out of our comfort zone. My daughter is going to help me out with this one, too.
Oh, nice.
At least
nice.
In terms of research. So I'm sure she wants to actually come on this one. So we'll see. But
okay.
So we're jumping into we're going to see what kind of what fossilized old men we really are.
yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So that's it.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah. Thanks everybody. And see you next week.